5:59, and you're listening to KBOO Portland. And coming up next is two back-to-back episodes of Making Contact. Stay tuned.
KBOO Community Radio is a proud co-sponsor of Varsity Cheerleader Werewolves Live from Outer Space, the musical, showing March 16th through March 31st on Fridays, Saturdays, and Sundays at the Chapel Theater in Milwaukee, Oregon. Varsity Cheerleader Werewolves Live from Outer Space is an original comedy musical featuring cheerleaders, rebellious youth, evil aliens, puppets, and fueled by the songs of the 80s. Again, that's Varsity Cheerleader Werewolves Live from Outer Space, the musical, showing March 16th through March 31st on Fridays, Saturdays, and Sundays at the Chapel Theater, 4107 Southeast Harrison Street in Milwaukee, Oregon. More information can be found at kboo.fm on the right side of the homepage under Community Events.
KBOO Community Radio is a proud co-sponsor of the Peace Jam Northwest on Saturday, April 7th and Sunday, April 8th at the Erb Memorial Union on the University of Oregon campus in Eugene. Open to teens of age 14 to 18, the Peace Jam Conference will include several addresses by Dr. Shireen Abadi, the first woman ever to become a judge in Iran and the first Muslim woman to win the Peace Prize. There will also be service projects, workshops in leadership, civic engagement, peace building, and more. Again, that's the Peace Jam Northwest on Saturday, April 7th, and Sunday, April 8th, at the Erb Memorial Union on the University of Oregon campus in Eugene. More information can be found at kboo.fm on the right side of the homepage under Community Events.
You can donate to us by going to radioproject.org and click on the big donate button. And don't forget to rate us on iTunes, which helps other listeners find us. Thanks, and here's the show.
Hi, I'm Marie Cha. On today's Making Contact,
we saw a movement where the people of Vietnam raised their fists alongside soldiers, alongside Black Panthers, with San Francisco State students, Asian young people in Chinatown, peace activists with Chicano Latino freedom fighters. Folks knew that the U.S. empire had many faces. Whether it was bombs destroying villages in Vietnam or deep oppression in the streets of Oakland. And their unity, that solidarity, was not just in a common struggle, but it was in a united front of resistance and resilience. The people were raising their fists and they were rising up.
50 years ago, the American war in Vietnam was at its height. There, people had already fought against Japanese and French colonial rule, and now the U.S. attempt at domination was once again turning family members, friends, and neighbors against each other. For the U.S. government, this was just another Cold War battleground, and the deaths of 2 to 4 million Vietnamese people was seen as collateral damage in establishing U.S. rule over the region. But people of color around the world saw the resistance in Vietnam as a source of inspiration. Today, we'll hear excerpts from an intergenerational teach-in held by the Vietnam Victory Coalition in 2015 called The Spirit of Vietnam is Stronger Than U.S. Bombs. Thuy Trang Nguyen was a core member of Viet Unity and the Vietnam Victory Coalition. She kicked off the event.
My name is Thuy Trang. I'm Thuy Trang Nguyen. I'm a daughter of four. I was born in Vietnam for 10 years after post-war Vietnam. With that say, I also left the country with my mother in refugee camp for 3 years, came to reunite it with my dad and my older brothers here in the United States in Oakland, where he found home. And then I lived here in Oakland for 23 years. I'm the only one that from my school, that who I know as a refugee, as a person from Oakland, as a person from Casamont, I'm the only class that went to Berkeley, so it was incredibly lonely. When I finished Berkeley, I started with a group called Viet Unity. They wanted to kind of interested in exploring the alternative to what is what we call now is the dominant narratives. And a lot of you all know is that the Vietnamese community in diaspora mostly support the U.S., so they pro-U.S. And so for a lot of us, taking that risk and exploring what it means to be a Vietnamese and a progressive really compartmentally. So for us, the work is about exploring, about healing, about understanding our own history, our own family history, and at the same time, taking that risk. Whereas my parents who came here, I think they already exhausted by the impact of war. You know, both of my family, my dad is on the south side, my mom, most of family, even including her younger brother, 16-year-old, were kind of lost his life during the revolution too. So there's a lot of complexity in the Vietnamese community that we all hold, and we need a space to talk about it. So that's the work that Viet Unity were able to create. I think it's important to acknowledge that Vietnam only have 40 years of independence. Growing up, I never told that story. The story of self-determination. So to really embody that story is kind of shake my core. And that's why we live in the United States, we don't talk about the imperialists. Such a contradiction. And when we talk about it, we kind of scare about it. And I feel like there's a nexus between the state violence of the police against community color here and the state of violence against the countries where I'm come from. The victory of Vietnam is a victory not just for the Vietnamese liberations, but also for all the oppressed.
In the 60s and 70s, people were also making these connections between the violence of the police against communities of color in the U.S. and U.S. military violence in the countries where people are from. At the time, Ngo Thanh Nhan was part of building the Union of Vietnamese. They formed critical alliances between Black, Brown, and Asian communities as they supported the self-determination of people in Vietnam and struggled against the racism of the white anti-war movement in the U.S.
My name is Ngo Thanh Nhan. I was born in Saigon in 1948 during the French occupation of Vietnam. My father's family was killed in 1928, and he ran away from home and joined the French army. And my brother joined the Republic of Vietnam army, and he was killed in 1974 by a napalm that dropped on the battlefield in order to declare victory. And so I was raised in Saigon. I was the best student in school, and I was selected to come to the United States by the U.S. Agency of International Development, USAID, Leadership Scholarship in 1968, and the first school I came to was San Jose State. At that time, Angela Davis was on trial in San Jose, and it was like a lot of activity in San Jose, a lot of students asking me about the Vietnam War. And when I came, Martin Luther King was assassinated, and my teacher gave me a speech of Luther King to read. The speech was Beyond Vietnam, 1 year before. I read it, and I turned anti-war immediately because it was related to the experience of the Vietnamese and the Black being discriminated and racially biased by the United States government. Of course, yeah, you know, it's like that. From that, I learned that Ho Chi Minh, when he first came to the United States, when he was in his 20s, he wrote about lynching. And he related to the struggle of the Black with the Vietnamese struggle for independence. So for 4 years right there, and one day I was shown a Namek sky slideshow on the weapon that was used in Vietnam. It was Agent Orange that was mentioned in there, and also the napalm bomb, which they put in phosphorus so that even though you got caught by it, you can't jump into the water. When you jump into the water, it burns more. And personnel bombs and all that sort of thing. And I was so devastated that we started to form a group of USAID scholarship students, about 30 of us, built the Union of Vietnamese out of that. The first thing we need was poster, and we were in Berkeley at that time. The Black Panther Party comrade come by, and I, do you need poster? You know, the next day they came out with two poster and leaflet. It was moving. But in any case, we have tried very much in the anti-war movement against racism, even in the movement. At that time, when we want the Union of Vietnamese members come to tell them that, you know, they support Seven Peace Point of the National Liberation Front, they said, no, that's too radical. At that time, we were usually escorted by Asian Left Caucus and the Black, who came to the coalition all the time like that, as a group. Otherwise, they wouldn't listen to me. They don't care what the Vietnamese say. They have a better idea how peace in Vietnam come about. But in any case, the Vietnamese did teach the U.S. a lesson in Vietnam.
In their seven peace points, the Vietnamese Liberation Front called for an immediate ceasefire between military forces and the withdrawal of all American troops. They made it clear that the Vietnamese people would settle issues of peace and reunification themselves without the interference of outside powers, that they would seek reparations from the U.S. for the destruction they caused, and that they wanted to have relationships with all countries, including the U.S. During the war in Vietnam, much of the white anti-war left was motivated by the images of brutality coming out of Vietnam, their opposition to the draft, and the deaths of U.S. soldiers. But for many people of color in the U.S., their opposition to the war was tied to their own struggles against police and economic violence in their communities here, and the struggles of people in the countries they came from against the stranglehold of the U.S., Israel, and other colonial powers. They were inspired by the resistance of the Vietnamese Liberation Front and actively worked to build relationships and learn from one another. Rabab Abdelhadi has been part of the Movement for National Liberation in Palestine for decades. She currently works as a professor of ethnic studies at San Francisco State University.
Vietnam has always stood by the Palestinians. In 1968, during the height of the Vietnamese War of Liberation, the Democratic Republic of Vietnam, under President Ho Chi Minh, established diplomatic relations with the PLO. During the Black September War of Jordan against the Palestinians, they sent food and medical supplies to the Palestinian resistance. In 1976, within less than a year of the victory of Vietnam against U.S. imperialism, Vietnam opened a mission for the Palestine Liberation Organization in Hanoi. And in 1982, during the Israeli invasion of Lebanon, the mission was upgraded to an embassy.
The Black Panther Party also found ways to build friendship with the Vietnamese Liberation Front. Emery Douglas was their minister of culture at the time.
There were many ways that the Black Panther Party was inspired. We had several delegations that went to North Vietnam during the 60s. We had comrades in Algeria who used to go meet with the Vietnamese. And so we always had these close links and connections. And one of our front pages of our newspaper, we were offering troops to go and fight in Vietnam. There had been some discussions, and there were Panthers who were prepared to go if that reality would have happened. Of course, they sent us a beautiful letter back saying thank you and no thank you, but if we ever need your services, we will give you a call.
In addition to building relationships between movements for self-determination in different parts of the world, groups were also learning from one another.
Perhaps the most important lesson, in addition to the role of the Vietnamese Communist Party in leading the National Liberation Front, is the clarification of Vietnam, who are the enemies and who are our friends. In the literature of the Palestinian movement reflects such strategy, especially the Palestinian radical forces. There is no ambiguity on U.S. imperialism, on Zionism, and Arab reactionary forces. The collaboration between our enemies is clear too. In March 1966, Moshe Dayan, the Israeli quote-unquote defense minister or minister of war, toured Vietnam as a guest of the U.S. military. After witnessing the American attack on the Cambodian border, he noted the similar strategies, and I quote, "The United States and Israel employ almost identical language in speaking of reprisal actions. The formula employed is that the cost involved in aiding the enemy must be made so high that those involved would no longer be able to pay it. This is what the Israeli Minister of War said about US and Israel. This also explains why and what Israel has learned from the US too. Israel used napalm on the Palestinian civilian population in Jerusalem and Bethlehem during the 1967 war, right after the visit of Moshe Dayan to Vietnam in 1966. Napalm was also used not only by the Israelis, but by King Hussein's military in September 1970 when they bombed Palestinian refugee camps in Jordan, because it was very important for the United States to keep its lackeys in power, such as the Jordanian regime. The second lesson that we learned, that our enemies are not only external, but they might be as dangerous as the external forces. And this is where the Jordanian regime comes in. In the case of Palestine, it wasn't only in Jordan, but during the Lebanese civil war and during the Israeli invasion of Lebanon, Israel created the South Lebanese army, just like the United States placed the regime in Saigon in place. They acted as the front line of attack against Palestinian and Lebanese anti-colonial forces. But Vietnamese example is not only about our enemies, it's also about the heroic resistance. The tunnels of Cu Chi have been reproduced in 2006 in the Lebanese resistance against the Israeli invasion of South Lebanon. They were also reproduced in Gaza. The tunnels in Gaza are the lifelines of the Palestinians who are under blockade by Israel. Until this very day, Vietnam remains imprinted in our minds and hearts as the example that a small country can defeat the mightiest force on earth.
The tunnels of Cu Chi were an extensive network of underground tunnels that connected Ho Chi Minh City to many other parts of the country. They allowed fighters with the Vietnamese Liberation Front to move covertly and gave people a place to hide during U.S. carpet bombing campaigns. The Panthers were also inspired by the strategy of the Vietnamese Liberation Front.
Our paper, we wanted it to be like, and Huey Newton used to talk about being a very portable operation, about like a guerrilla operation, where you could pick it up and take it on the move at any moment in the early days of the organization. And that was inspired by the Vietnamese. Also, I'd like to close with Dr. King, MLK, Dr. King, when he talked about, if you go to YouTube, and you look at the video, why I'm opposed to the war in Vietnam, you can understand why he was assassinated. He said he began to talk about it in the context of linking the racism in this country, the extreme materialism in this country, and the militarism to the linking that to what was going on in Vietnam.
The generation of activists that came up in the 90s and 2000s built on these connections and took those questions a step further. Prishni Murillo is part of that generation and works with the Chicana Moratorium Coalition.
First of all, I want to say that I am extremely honored to be in the presence of all this history and all these elders. I know there's a lot of resistance to being called elders in the community. You know, our legacy keepers, our history holders. But I am also very humbled and honored to be here and add a perspective, a Chicano perspective, that I kind of grew up in as I became an organizer here in the Bay. And so I'm going to kind of share my story as a gateway to talk about the Chicano moratorium in the mid-90s, or actually early 90s, when the anti-immigrant kind of fervor hit the West Coast. And at that time, I was a teenager, undocumented, really busy and concerned and upset about the street violence that was happening amongst my peers. And in the midst of trying to grapple with the reality of the street violence, but as well as the uncertainty of my life and my family's life in the midst of this political climate, I sought to organize. And it was the one tangible way I knew how to fight back. And so I was lucky that at that point, the older folks that were mobilized from the 60s, 70s, and 80s were still around and were really supportive anchors in guiding our anger at that point and our wanting to do something. And that's how I stepped into an organization. It was called Fund Our Youth or Face the Consequences. And it originally came up as a fight to really address the expulsion rate, the suspension rate, and to get kind of like the homeboys in the mission and the homegirls in the mission really to fight for something realistic and tangible in our lives. But it also coincided with the anti-immigrant kind of statewide political climate and political discussion. And so for us to know that we were fighting for immediate needs of our peers, as we were fighting for the dignity of our families, made sense. And we kind of rode that train. But through our organizing, we were constantly exposed to, like, you know, ideas that preceded us. And so I'll talk a little bit about the moratorium story that I had never heard, and the organizing of the Chicanos in the 60s that really led to the foundation and actually really strengthened my self-identity and the pathway to the organizing that I continue to do today. I think we all know the culture that existed in the streets and the electricity regarding, like, liberation, right? And the big question, I think Vietnam and the battle in Vietnam really brought into question, one, what is our role as subjects of this imperial machine, right? And also, what is our role in relationship to this land base and the homes that we occupy here at home, and in relationship to the other communities in which we share this space? And in 1968, Corky Gonzalez, who is not very well known, but for us in the Chicano community, we consider him kind of like the Malcolm X, who really spoke fire to the system. So Corky Gonzalez, look him up. Que viva, presente. And he called for the first National Chicano Youth Conference in Denver, Colorado in 1968 as an opportunity to really grapple with this discussion about, like, who are we, what's our goal, what's our agenda, how are we resisting the war, and what are we gonna do at home? And one of the main charges that came out of that was for, and I will say, close to 1,000 people showed up to this one national conference. Over 5 different states were represented, mostly young people, and the charge was to go back home and organize. Organize local education sessions, organize local actions against the war, to join in body and in actions all the anti-war mobilizations in our homes, in our barrios. And as a result of all that action from in 1968, 1969, in 1970, the first ever mass mobilization of brown people in the Southwest took place in East LA. 30,000 people took the streets in East LA in 1970 with a united call to end the war in Vietnam, but there also to be a Chicano moratorium to participate in the war machine and bring justice to our communities. Yes. It was a major endeavor for that time, no social media and all that other good stuff, not a lot of resources, but people found their way. We've heard stories of hitchhiking, you know, all kinds of stories leading to that day. But that day also completed with, and I'm not gonna get to share too much, but with people dying as a result of police rushing the protest. What I'll say, and what was translated to the younger population that I am a part of, the younger generation, is that many seeds grew out of that early mobilization in the Chicano community. One continues, and it feeds into our own confusion, which is the sense of false nationalism connected to the nation states and our home communities, our perception of our home communities, of our parents, our grandparents, and what we're consistently fed in international mass media, which we're foreigners, we have no history here, we're all immigrants. But at that time, it really sparked another perspective that, you know, that I continue to carry with, which is question the legitimacy of the nation states as we know it, but more importantly, to really highlight and redefine our relationship to land, our ability to fight for liberation. I think it has been spoken consistently about how in the Vietnam War and the success of the Vietnam War really sparked the imagination of us to really consider how that is possible. But it's really, and I think that's the challenge within my own community, rooted in our ability to reassess and redefine our relationship to the land and to our connection to the land that we are a part of, and that we might not be the original and indigenous inhabitants of these particular places like Oakland, like LA, like Denver. We are part of the legacy, and we are either perpetuators of the invasion and colonization, or we are either the seeds that are actually gonna really topple this machine that continues to wreak havoc across the earth.
So what was the spirit of Vietnam, and how does that spirit live on today? Alex Hing wrote about this in an essay for the book The People Make the Peace. He currently works with the Rainbow Council of Elders.
The spirit of Vietnam is stronger than U.S. bombs. I would like us to understand that spirit is not just a word, but a breath of energy that deeply connects us to the earth and ultimately to the cosmos through our hearts. It means we are talking about the spirituality generated by the land and the people of Vietnam, which are one and embraced by peace-loving people all over the world in the war against U.S. imperialism, a culture of death. The spirit of Vietnam burst upon the world during the Tet Offensive in 1968, when the National Liberation Front of South Vietnam attacked over 100 cities, towns, and villages controlled by the U.S. and their puppets, including the U.S. Embassy in Saigon. And people, especially people of color around the world, embraced it and believed that U.S. imperialism could not only be defeated, but a world without war, without money, without oppression, and generating the full creative potential of humanity can be built. When this small third world country, through tremendous sacrifice, courage, and spirit, would now allow the most evil methods ever created to destroy them, we empathized with them and opened up another front. The spirit enabled a junior high school dropout who was our member to transform himself and break down France Fanon to a group of views on how colonialism and imperialism generates feelings of inferiority among people of color that can become overcome through revolution. The spirit was with us when we broke the stranglehold that the US-backed KMT, the Taiwan-based Nationalist Party, held over our community. Until their power was challenged by the Red Guards, the KMT completely controlled the politics, culture, and economy of Chinatown. The spirit of Vietnam was with people of color and women who were called upon to combat racism and sexism within the anti-war movement so that the war could end as quickly as possible. The Bay Area Asian Coalition Against the War built support for the Vietnamese demands at the Paris Peace Conference and within the Asian American communities. Bacall directly confronted whites in the anti-war movement that their slogan, "Bring Our Boys Home," was sexist and racist because it did not consider what U.S. imperialism was doing to the people of Vietnam. The slogan we chanted was, "Down with U.S. imperialism, Ho 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 Chi Minh, Vietnam is going to win." And that none of us considered that treasonous or even courageous, but right. The spirit of Vietnam was embraced by people of color who played a pivotal role in ending the war at great sacrifice, such as the Chicano moratorium. And to those who say that blacks were concerned only about the civil rights movement, denies the positions taken by most of the leaders of the black liberation struggle, including Malcolm X, Muhammad Ali, Dr. Martin Luther King, the Black Panther Party, and that one of the first national organizations to openly condemn the U.S. war in Vietnam was the Student Nonviolent Coordinating Committee. Understanding the spirit of Vietnam recognizes the empathy and support of the Vietnamese for U.S. black liberation, even in the midst of their own struggle. As Nan mentioned, Ho Chi Minh wrote an essay on lynching, a little-known aspect of American civilization, analyzing this racist practice as a means of terror to subjugate black people in America. The U.S. anti-war movement and the Black Liberation Movement received the spirit of Vietnam, which is stronger than US bombs. It is a spirit of revolution that is now being taken up by a new generation. Thank you.
Beloved, aren't you joyful when school bell ringing, students playing, books and notes and lectures piling? You have come back, beloved. The sweetness of coffee surprises you in every taste. Cuộc sống cuồng điên, bóng thiên đường trần thế, rầm rập khác người tuôn dậy đàn em trẻ, rác bông vàng da, tình yêu rộng không ngờ. Madness of life, the gate of heaven on earth, masses of people struggling and children and youth, don't you feel burning in your yellow skin, the boundlessness of love that surprises you in every look?
That does it for this edition of Making Contact. You can learn more about resistance to the American War in Vietnam at our website, radioproject.org. You can also check out past shows, subscribe to our weekly podcast, and make a difference by supporting our work. If today's show raised questions for you, share it with a friend. You can find us on Facebook and Twitter at @making_contact. Special thanks to Thuy Giang Nguyen and the Vietnam Victory Coalition for organizing this event and for allowing us to air excerpts of it. I originally recorded and broadcast this event for Apex Express. The music you heard was played live at the teach-in by No Tan Yan. The Making Contact team includes Lisa Redman, Anita Johnson, Monica Lopez, RJ Lozada, and Sabine Blazant.
RJ Lozada here. If you like what you're hearing, please donate to us. Visit radioproject.org, and there you can find a donate. The show.
On the next Making Contact.
If there were no Black Lives Matter, there would be no Women's March. We've set the foundation. And the idea that this new round of feminism is coming out of the Women's March is just false, because we are feminists and Black Lives Matter. And it's largely been led by Black women and queer people and trans people. And so this idea that white women get to own feminism, I think, is super disturbing. But what it's important for me in these moments is to not let the hijack continue, and that we get to remind people the story and what's been happening and why Black Lives Matter is a feminist movement. And actually, the resistance didn't start on November 6th when white women decided to wake up.
I'm Anita Johnson. Since the election of Donald Trump, there have been significant efforts to racially profile activists and aggressively prosecute protesters. In 2017, nearly 20 states proposed bills that would restrict people's rights to protest. The proposed laws would increase the penalties for protesting in large groups and ban individuals from wearing masks during demonstrations. The American Civil Liberties Union said, more than 30 separate anti-protest bills have been introduced in an unprecedented level of hostility towards protesters in the 21st century. Today on Making Contact, we hear from Patrice Khan Cullors, the co-founder of Black Lives Matter and the author of the new book, When They Call You a Terrorist, a Black Lives Matter memoir. In this conversation, hosted by longtime organizer Kat Brooks, we hear Patrice Cullors' insights on Black liberation, police terrorism, and the criminalization of activism in America as shaped by an existing political landscape that seeks to neutralize the movement, criminalize activists of color, and shield law enforcement from public scrutiny.
So I want to read a bit for y'all from this beautiful, beautiful book, and then we'll sit and chat it up with my sister Kat. We are stardust. I write to keep in contact with our ancestors and to spread truth to people. Sonia Sanchez. Days after the election of 2016, Asha sent me a link to a talk by astrophysicist Neil deGrasse Tyson. "We have to have hope," she says to me across 3,000 miles. She in Brooklyn, me in Los Angeles. We listen together as Dr. deGrasse Tyson explains that the very atoms and molecules in our bodies are traceable to the crucibles and centers of stars that once upon a time exploded into gas clouds. And those gas clouds formed other stars, and those stars possess the divine right mix of properties needed to create not only planets, including our own, but also people, including us, me and her. He is saying that not only are we in the universe, but that the universe is in us. He is saying that we, human beings, are literally made out of stardust. And I know when I hear this, and I know when I hear him say this, that he is telling the truth, because I have seen it since I was a child. The magic, the stardust we are, and the lives of the people I come from. I watched it in the labor of my mother, a Jehovah's Witness, and a woman who worked two and sometimes three jobs at a time, keeping other people's children, working the reception desks at gyms, telemarketing, doing anything and everything for 16 hours a day, the whole of my childhood in the Van Nuys barrio where we lived. My mother, cacao brown and smooth, disowned by her family for the children she had as a very young and unmarried woman. My mother never giving up despite never making a living wage. I saw it in the thin brown face of my father, a boy out of Cajun country, a wounded healer whose addictions were born of a world that did not love him and told him so not once but constantly. My father who always came back, who never stopped trying to be a better version of himself, there were no mirrors for. And I knew it because I am the 13th generation progeny of a people who survived the holes of slave ships, survived the chains, the whips, the months laying in their own and piss, the human beings legislated as not human beings who watched their names, their languages, their goddesses and gods, the arc of their dances and beats of their songs, the majesty of their dreams, their very family snatched up and stolen, disassembled and discarded, and despite this built language and honored God and created movement and upheld love. What could they be but stardust, these people who refuse to die, who refuse to accept the idea that their lives did not matter, that their children's lives did not matter. Ashe.
When was the first time you were called a terrorist?
The first time I'm called a terrorist is definitely somewhere in 2015 or 2016. I want to say it was before the Dallas shootings, that there were mumbling of us being terrorists, Black Lives Matter, both the leadership but also the organization being a terrorist organization. But it was definitely the Dallas shootings, in which not just right-wing pundits but elected officials and appointed officials were calling us terrorists. And I think it was a moment where I saw my face and folks who I love faces and the headlines of Bill O'Reilly and the headlines of Breitbart News. Yes, I think that was the first time.
You mentioned Texas, and specifically you're talking about Micah Johnson, who at a Black Lives Matter protest ended up killing five police officers, who then responded by sending a robot to blow him up. When you woke up that morning and that was on the news?
I had just had my child just a few months before. I think I was 3 or 4 months out, and I remember first, before I got the news, because I was trying to stay away from the news and social media. I was supposed to be on maternity leave. I got a bunch of text messages, and they were like, "Did you see what happened in Dallas? Like, are you, like, we have to get an emergency phone call." And as I looked and you know, for folks of color, the first question we always ask about a shooter is, what race is he? Because it will determine the outcome. of what happens to that person, but also what happens to us. And so the moment they said the shooter was black, I was like, okay, like they're about to go after us. And that's exactly what happened. And we spent the next 48 hours to 72 hours trying to navigate how to have a conversation about the state's need to blame any black person's behavior, especially if it was against law enforcement, on Black Lives Matter.
And there's this thing that happens, I mean, glad we joke about it though, in less serious situations, right? That when something happens, like if you're black, you're praying, you're brown, you're praying, right? Mm-hmm. And praying that it's somebody else. Mm-hmm. But then there's this dynamic that happens with people of color, within certain pockets of people of color. But then this group trots themselves out and apologizes, right? For whatever that person has done on behalf of the race of people. Mm-hmm. But when Dylann Roof, right, murdered those folks, you never see white people trot people out and apologize for the brutality that they exercise on other people.
Yes. You are right, Kat. I think, you know, it was such an interesting moment. And for us, if the audience remembers, this was like the height of a resurgence of protesting because Philando and because Alton Sterling had just been murdered. And so the Dallas protests were for Philando and Alton Sterling. And the moment those officers were killed, it took a sharp left turn. And I think the work of BLM in that moment was to keep the momentum for our movement. And I think it was really important that we were able to say, this is our focus. Our folks are dying. We have to continue to pay attention to that. It's a tricky dynamic, I think, when you're constantly being blamed for harms against other people. And it's easy to fall into the trap of apologizing. And I think part of the work that we have to do is show up for what we know is true, which is black folks are dying at the hands of law enforcement every single day. And just last year, 1,000 people died at the hands of the police, almost doubled from the year before. We have to continue to have that conversation, even when it's in the spotlight and even when it's not.
Does that conversation shift or evolve when we are now in a dynamic of the Black Identity Extremist Report? Right. So for folks who don't know, but I imagine this is a room full of folks who do know, right, the FBI released a report called Black Identity Extremist, specifically about black people that are doing work. And allegedly or perceive that there is danger to their lives by law enforcement. The whole report is filled with allegedly, perceived, perhaps, right? No concrete admission, of course, that there's a war on black life. Does the conversation shift at all?
It does. I mean, I want to just say a few things about that. Number one is that the black identity extremist label is made up by the FBI. Didn't exist before the FBI created it. So that should make everybody feel mad suspect. We're not out here with like black identity extremist hats and pens and t-shirts.
I'm about to get a shirt.
I know, I've seen the pens. But that happened after the FBI created it. And I just think that's important, right? They created a whole identity for black activists and black activism. And two, that there's always been a long history of black people who have fought for our freedom that have been labeled as terrorists, who are labeled as counterinsurgents. And I think with this black identity extremist label, we should see it in its historical context. And I think I'm curious about this moment because what we didn't have in the height of COINTELPRO is elected officials challenging the CIA publicly. What we do have in this moment is some elected officials, specifically Congresswoman Karen Bass, who has taken it the charge to hold Attorney General Jeff Sessions accountable. the FBI director, and really take them to task about this identity. And I think that's actually really important. And I think that's really necessary to have that conversation.
Trump. This idea of black identity extremists in particular within the age of Trump and the war on dissent that he's waging, right? How does our organizing shift? Does it shift?
Yes, it does, and no, it doesn't. I think what's important is for us to understand that there's a long-haul fight. This particular moment, while we have to be responsive, we also can't get too wrapped up in reaction. I think what's been brilliant about the last 4.5 years is that we haven't gone anywhere. And the work has been ever more clear. I think the other piece is sometimes we get really caught up in sort of the national landscape when there's so much local work to be doing, when there's such a rich local fight. And in my opinion, and what we've seen historically, is the local really impacts the national. And if we can stay on the ground locally, if we could do that work, we could change the face of this country. We can look at... we can look at decriminalization, we can look at gay marriage, right, state by state, city by city, county by county, and eventually it spreads like wildfire across the country. So, my advice to organizers is always try to stay as local focused as possible with the clarity of a national and global lens.
Under the Obama administration, we saw a lot of reforms take place. We saw the Blue Ribbon Commission being formed. We saw body cameras. We saw the co-optation of the term community policing. We saw people talking about diversity in police departments. Can policing, from your perspective, be reformed?
No.
Why not?
Following your lead, facilitator. Flat out no. And I'm an abolitionist, a staunch abolitionist.
What does that mean for you?
I was just going to give that definition. So abolition is not just the getting rid of something. It's also the imagining of something else, the building of something else. And so abolition has a long history in this country, the abolition of slavery. Slavery was never really abolished. We could talk about the 13th Amendment. And policing, the court systems, jails and prisons, surveillance, is all in the prison police apparatus. And I believe that that should no longer exist. I think if we have policing, prisons, court, surveillance, in any form or fashion, black people will always be suffering from it. We will always be bearing the brunt of those agencies. And so the work, I believe, is to abolish and abolish these systems. And then the other part of the work is to build institutions that are really the foundation around transformative justice. Community accountability, and a deep desire for black folks to have our dignity, to be cared for in the ways that we deserve to be cared for. So this time especially, I think we should be calling for abolition. Under 45, it's easy because so much of what he's doing is egregious for us to sort of just to be like, all right, if we just get this, right, if we just get these small reforms, it's easy to sort of feel the whole of grief that we feel collectively because of this regime. But I think in these moments when it's heightened, right, that we should be calling for abolition, that we should be naming it, we should feel unapologetic in naming it, and we should be creating our local movements to mirror what abolition could look like locally. Part of what that looks like, I think, is requesting and demanding that we divest from law enforcement. I know that APTP and many Bay Area groups have made a call for
divestment from Oakland OPD. I know that in Los Angeles we've made a call to divest from LAPD. And what we've seen is that in all of the social service budgets, and it's a tragedy that law enforcement is called a social service, but in all the social service budgets, law enforcement is the budget that's always increased. It's always given the most money. It's the most resourced. And everything else, access to employment, access to healthy food, access to adequate public education, is divested from. And so we need to flip that. And we have to be courageous enough to call for that. And our elected officials, who are often backing law enforcement, have to show up and say, okay, we cannot allow this to happen anymore.
We'll hear more from Patrice Kahn-Cullors in a few moments on Making Contact, a production of the National Radio Project. If you'd like to find out more about this week's show, check out our website at radioproject.org. Sign up for our podcast or follow us on Twitter. Our handle is making_contact. Now back to Patrice Kahn-Cullors, the co-founder of Black Lives Matter, on Making Contact.
One of the things people might not know about you that I love and adore about you is your commitment to healing. Mm-hmm. So we have a question. My sister, mm-hmm. Our people are feeling besieged by the real and psychological assault on our body and space. How can we respond and keep our sanity?
Yeah. I love that question.
I knew you would.
Yeah, so important. Well, a few things. I mean, I really deeply believe that a part of Black people's reparations package should be a therapist, each one of us. I'm going to say it enough that when we decide to go back to the reparations conversation, it's going to be like 0.1. And if you don't believe in talk therapy, some sort of healing modality, you know, something that you have access to on a daily basis, on a weekly basis. I'm a firm believer in therapy. I've been in it since I was 21 years old. And I deeply believe in community as a source of healing, being with friends, family, loved ones, spending a lot of time laughing. I deeply believe in courageous conversations, you know, as part of how we heal. It's never fun to have funkiness towards other folks in your movement. So I think that's another part of healing. And then there's like all the other things. I'm in California now, so y'all will get it. I was in other places, they were like, what? I like crystals and sage and I build lots of altars everywhere I go. You know?
But how does a girl from the hood end up playing with crystals and sage?
I was always hella weird though. Like, I was just the weird one, trust and believe. I would come out, my mom be like, oh, that's what you're wearing today. I had a deep inspiration for me around spirit was Harriet Tubman. The earliest memories of reading about her was her visions that she would have. And I was like, ooh, I there's something in that feels like it pulls me. So I always was like very clear about spirit. And, you know, in the book I talk about, I grew up Jehovah's Witness, and that was definitely not the religion that I wanted to be in as a child. It was very confusing. I didn't understand how the world had just been here for 2,000 years.
And you were like, what do you call it, exiled?
I wasn't. My mother was.
Your mother was exiled?
Multiple times.
Because she had your brother at...
Because she had children out of wedlock.
Which means that she could go to the church, but she couldn't talk to anybody.
And people could not talk to her. And if they did, she had to tell them, I'm disfellowshipped. And they would say, okay, and back up away from her. She was like a leper. It was very traumatic, actually, as a child. So I was like, why would I want to be a part of this? That don't make no sense. But I was like trying to find, I knew that I believed in spirit. And like, you know, no shade to the atheists in the house. I knew I believed in spirit, and I wanted, what I loved about the Kingdom Hall was connection to something bigger than me, something broader than me, being in community, and so I really longed for that and eventually would find my spiritual home.
I've got a couple of questions with the same theme, so I'm going to go there, particularly about the work between
the Latinx community and the Black community. I'm blending y'all's questions mm-hmm. together. And dealing with anti-Blackness in the Latinx community.
How do we deal with it?
And then move forward as mm-hmm. allies.
Yeah, well, you know, this is a good question, and I've answered a bit of this on the tour, which is like, how do we build relationships with each other? Sometimes we think that the way we build relationships with each other is like, do a project together, start a campaign together, which is true. That's a good way. Doing work together is a good way to be in relationship to one another. But there's all this time in between. Where we should be breaking bread together. We should be hanging out together. We should be getting to know each other. We should get to know our pet peeves. I mean, there's a way in which I deeply desire our work to feel like we're building family and not just pounding to the concrete and doing work. Because that's when I know that someone has my back. I know when someone has my back because you've seen me ugly cry, you know, you've hung out with me and my baby, you've seen me vulnerable, not just on stage. There's a way in which I think we prioritize campaigns that are going to bring us together, and we've seen that that's, you know, what's love got to do with it? Like, we have to actually be building foundations with one another.
The other thing that folks might not know about you is that you are an accomplished artist and have been an artist most of your life.
Mm-hmm.
The role of art in the liberation movement.
It's everything. Black people are creative people. I think we are deeply connected to creativity and art, and so it weaves throughout everything that we do and every movement that we're a part of. And I often some of the best artists that I've met are organizers. And when I first joined the movement, I was 17 years old, and I remember one of my mentors saying to me, "You got to choose. It's either going to be this organizing or art." And I was like, "Nope." We're about to do both of these things. And I'm so grateful that I was stubborn in that way, and that I said no, because I knew that I needed both. I needed both to fill. I couldn't be someone that was just in a conservatory and did art all day or theater all day. I would be very bored. I'm not someone that just could be like strictly policy campaign work. I think it is important that we marry those things. And art and cultural work also gives us more space to feel and imagine how our world can be different. Sometimes when you get stuck in the rut of campaign and policy, you can't be imaginative. And I think art allows us to be imaginative.
There's this big push right now to go to the polls. It's like sort of the knee-jerk mm-hmm. reaction to Trump. BLM and electoral politics, mm-hmm. yes, no?
Sure, and that's not gonna get us free.
Say more.
Well, okay, so it's a few things. For me, it's all about strategy. And for folks who've read Marx, it's time, place, and condition, right? What's the time, what's the place, what's the condition? The charge for electoral power is, I think it's an important charge. I don't think it's a charge that we should be neglectful of or not insert ourselves in. But if we steer ourselves, you know, the whole ship in that direction, we're gonna lose a lot. And what I mean by that is the only good elected official is the elected official that is following the base, is following the people. And what I argue is that the right now are being really good elected officials to their base. Mm. They are showing up for their base. And the Democratic Party that is supposed to be, we're supposed to be their base, has completely neglected us and have neglected us for a very long time. And so the conversation of electoral politics and where they're at right now, I think, is a fine place to start. but we actually need to go further. And the further is, we should be questioning why we live in a country that only has two parties.
And the time is 6:59, and you're listening to KBOO Portland, and coming up next is Calculated Conversations.
KBOO Community Radio is proud to co-sponsor One Word's Alive Tour on Thursday, April 5th, 7 p.m. at Specs Records and Tapes, 8216 North Denver Avenue in Portland. This in-store performance by One Word for his Alive Spring Tour will be followed by several sets from local hip-hop support, Lisa Vasquez, Burt Sienna, Valvoline, and Northern Draw. This is an all-ages show, again, all ages. That's One Word's Alive Tour at Specs Records, 8216 North Denver Avenue in Portland on Thursday, April 5th from 7 p.m. to 9:30 p.m. More information can be found at kboo.fm on the right side of the homepage under Community Events.
Thank you, KBOO members, for supporting this great station, and you can apply today to join our board of directors to help serve our community and put your gifts and talents to great use. The role played by our KBOO board of directors is essential. It's a great way to become part of the team that is guiding our daily work and representing the interests and visions of all our members. There is a time commitment of about 15 hours a month, and you must be a KBOO member. To apply, go to kboo.fm and fill out an application, or stop by the station to pick up a paper copy. The deadline to apply is April 16, 2018. We need folks who love KBOO and are committed to our community values. KBOO needs you. Apply today.
Yo, man, it's a lot of brothers out there flaking and perpetrating but scared to kick reality.
Man, you've been doing all this dope producing. You ain't had a chance to show them what time it is.
So what you want me to do?
Spread yourself.